Good morning. Very nice to be with you all, and very much looking forward to our sessions this morning and over the next couple of weeks. And it I was going to say it's such a blessing being with you, but that would be conditional on the stand here holding my notes. So, yes, I think we're on firm foundation now. But truly, it's a great honor and blessing to be with you all. And, you know, I've known many of you for many years. And I know that the Harvesters is a very special ministry. And it's more than just a class. It's a community in the true sense. And so I appreciate so much your ministry, your witness, both here at Perimeter Church and far beyond over these many years. And also, I know we all want to be in prayer for John and Colleen as they move on to new areas of ministry. And he has been, I'm sure, such a blessing and such a source of encouragement over the years. So I know we all want to continue to hold them in our prayers regularly. Well, this morning I wanted to talk about, and for the next couple of Sundays, wanted to talk about a uniquely American tradition, and that is Thanksgiving, and the background, basically the backstory for the Pilgrims, Plymouth, and Thanksgiving. And this is, as I said, it's one of the really unique aspects of being an American and being an American Christian. And you probably know quite a bit about this history, but I hope to fill in some of the gaps and just offer basically a constant reminder of how absolutely privileged we are as American Christians. You know, we are, in all of Christian history, in the 2,000 years of Christian history, we are absolutely the most privileged, the most prosperous, the most free Christians who have ever lived. There is so much to be thankful for and grateful for. And so I hope our sessions will be a further reminder to that extent. Now, I understand we have the outline up on the screen, so if you'd like to follow along and perhaps take some notes as we go through this material. So with that, let's begin the outline. Gary, please. All right. And I wanted to start with what I call the English colonial vision and this idea of English exceptionalism. Now, we hear a lot about American exceptionalism. That needs to be carefully defined, of course. But prior to American exceptionalism, there was this concept of English exceptionalism, and this begins basically in the Elizabethan era. Now, that's the second half of the 1500s. You remember the Protestant Reformation started about 1517, 1520, and England had a very, very difficult history in those early decades of the Protestant Reformation. In fact, they actually had a Catholic monarch near the middle of that century, Mary Tudor, whom we sometimes refer to as Bloody Mary, who was a vicious persecutor of Protestants. After she dies, she is succeeded by eventually Elizabeth, and so Elizabeth takes us through the second half of the 1500s there. And during this Elizabethan period, many Englishmen came to believe that England was basically the new Israel in world history. There was talk about England being a covenanted people, and this was, again, kind of in the heady days following the death of that Catholic tyrant, Mary Tudor, or Bloody Mary Tudor, and with the ascension of Elizabeth to the throne and so on. Now, Elizabeth was really just kind of a generic Protestant. She didn't take her faith all that seriously. But for both political and probably personal reasons, she had to identify with the Protestant faith rather than the Roman Catholic faith. But having said that, she was not all that interested in theological matters, to say the least. Now, during this period, John Fox popularized this chosen nation theme in an influential book which he wrote called Acts and Monuments. You know it as Fox's Book of Martyrs. And in that book, he asserted that England was a, quote, peculiar nation chosen by Providence for a very unique mission in this world. And, of course, under Queen Elizabeth's reign, you know, one of the primary most important issues and events that transpired was the sailing of the Spanish Armada on England to depose her and reimpose Catholicism in England. The Spanish Armada, of course, turned out to be a total debacle, a disaster. This is in 1588. And following that Spanish Armada debacle, this idea of English exceptionalism became increasingly accepted among many English. In 1644, amid all the enthusiasm of the early years of the English Civil War, John Milton wrote a book called Areopagita, and he said in that book that England is a chosen nation before any other, a nation of prophets and sages and worthies. Now, this was not a totally unique concept. Other European nations felt very similar, including Catholic Spain, the Holy Roman Empire, and even Russia claimed to be a uniquely Christian nation. Back in this time, as you know, any European would claim to be a Christian unless they were among the very small minority of Jews, for instance, or a few Muslims. Other than that, everyone claimed to be a Christian. So the idea was that European civilization was analogous to Christendom. Okay, a false concept, but a very common one at the time. Now, one historian writes this, "But of all the manifestations of national idolatry in Europe, the most virulent strain was actually in France. So not only did the English consider themselves to be a uniquely Christian nation, but the French did as well. And being of French ancestry, that's startling for me to even imagine. But nonetheless, that was the status quo back in those days. Now, let's take a look at the motives for English colonization, as you see on your screen there. And I want to start first with the personal and economic motive. And throughout the 1600s, more than 500,000 people sailed from England and Europe to North America, over 500,000 people. Now, most of these were lower class or middle class commoners. And America offered an opportunity to many of these people for a better life if they could survive, of course. And many Englishmen migrated to America in order to acquire their own farmland, which was inaccessible back in England. And during the first century of the colonization, nearly half of these settlers came as indentured servants. So basically, they were almost analogous to slaves for a set number of years, usually about 7 years, after which they would be set up with the resources they needed to be a productive, independent person. But many of them came as indentured servants originally. And so about 25% of this colonial population came from the ranks of the urban poor in England. So personal economic opportunities that they thought would be available here in America if they could survive, in contrast to life back in England. Now, a second motive for colonization, and this is something that the state itself promoted, was national and economic prosperity. And throughout the 17th and 18th centuries, the English government was very actively involved in promoting colonization as well. And the dominant economic philosophy, as many of you know back in those days, this is before capitalism became dominant, the economic philosophy that was dominant was called mercantilism. And the goal of mercantilism was to make a nation as rich as possible and as self-sufficient as possible. The measure of wealth back in those days would have been the accumulation of gold and silver reserves and a favorable balance of trade. And so colonies were an integral part of national prosperity. And colonies were of course, an integral part of establishing effective trade relationships. So, for instance, the mother country, like England, could exploit the colonies for its own economic benefit. The colonies would provide raw materials to the mother country. And in return, the mother country could sell back to the colonies manufactured goods. And so this relationship basically profited both the mother country, England, and the colonies here in America as well. But as time went on, they benefited the colonies less and less. Now, a third factor was the political motive. And some Englishmen migrated to or immigrated to America to avoid harassment from local officials or from the Stuart monarchs of the 1600s. And many of these political dissidents believed in local self-government and wanted to escape the tyranny of monarchs and other local officials back in England. The English government oftentimes encouraged and actually sponsored immigration in order to rid the cities of unemployed people, dissidents, political dissidents, social dissidents, and other undesirables. Now, English officials regarded the colonies essentially as a dumping ground for convicts, for debtors, for malcontents of other types, of all kinds, social malcontents, political, and also religious dissidents or malcontents as well. Now, a few colonists were hardy adventurers and soldiers of fortune, and they came to America because they were essentially dissatisfied with the settled nature of English or European civilization, and they were eager to get here and explore the wildlands of North America and maybe even mingle with the natives. So a few came just out of a sense of adventure. And then fifthly, as you see there, there was the religious component. And a small but very influential number of Englishmen migrated to America primarily for religious reasons. And from the outset, English civil religion was an integral part of the colonial impulse. And in fact, religion was probably the main factor in the founding of more colonies here in North America than was the economic component itself. So in terms of kind of a general assessment of all of this, many of these motives for colonization were set forth in a very popular book in England by an Anglican minister by the name of Richard Hakluyt. And in 1584, he laid the theoretical and the, you might say, even the theological foundations for the British Empire in a book called A Discourse Concerning Western Planting. And in that book, this minister, Anglican minister, Richard Hakluyt, put forth what he believed to be the best arguments for England actively promoting colonization in North America. And among those would be that it would provide geopolitical advantage for England itself. It would strengthen the Royal Navy. It would provide overseas naval bases in the event of a war with Spain. Those kind of encounters were always a constant threat. He thought that colonies in America would increase national wealth. He also believed that it was an integral part of a mercantile economic system. It would provide colonies would provide raw materials for England, and furthermore strengthen the economy there in England. Also, he argues that colonies in North America would relieve overpopulation and employ, as he put it, idle men. In other words, uneducated, unemployed, what he referred to as lusty youths, young men who didn't have enough to do in English society and were having a hard time finding adequate employment. So he thought that encouraging their colonization would help the social situation there in England, and perhaps they could be more productive if they came to the 13 colonies. Now, another factor was actually to discover a Northwest Passage. And if you look at the date here, this is only about 90 years after Christopher Columbus inadvertently discovered, you know, the Western Hemisphere. And so European explorers were still searching for alternative trade routes to Asia. They still were not aware of how large the Earth was. They thought the Earth was about 60% the size that it actually is. So they thought that this land blockage that they encountered on the east coast of America was just a temporary impediment, but just maybe a few hundred miles beyond would be Japan and China. So they're still searching for a Northwest Passage to active trade with Asia. And then lastly, Richard Hakluyt puts forth this motivation for colonization, and that is to, in his words, extend the Reformed religion. So when we look at this sort of as a composite, colonial society was, from the very beginning, very much of a mixed bag. Some colonists were dissidents or malcontents. They had fundamental problems with English society for one reason or another. Many objected to the English political or the religious situation in England. Others believed English society was too classist and it lacked economic and social opportunities that would probably be available if they came to the 13 colonies. Some of these immigrants were debtors and various types of poor people. Some were the dregs of English society. Some were criminals, including felons. In fact, in the 60 years leading up to the American Revolution, England transported about 50,000 convicted felons to the 13 colonies. Some, however, were very solid middle-class professionals and artisans and craftsmen and farmers. And some were among England's best and most industrious and most talented people. And some were very, very devout Christians who came to America primarily for religious liberty. So with that brief background, let's take a look at religious diversity in colonial America. And I'll just briefly go through some of this because it would take a pretty extended period of time to go into any detail here. But colonial America, by the time of the American Revolution, in fact, actually decades before the American Revolution, colonial America was the most religiously diverse civilization in the entire world. Christians who came to America represented a variety of sects, but three basic traditions. And one would be, of course, mainline Protestant. We'll talk about some of those groups. One would be Roman Catholic. Roman Catholics were just a very tiny minority at the time of the American Revolution, but they were present from almost the outset of American colonization. And then thirdly, there was the Free Church, so-called Free Church tradition. In other words, these so-called nonconformist factions who came to America. And although the process took generations to effect, there was much opposition along the way to all of this. And by the time of the American Revolution, Americans generally had more religious freedom than any other people on Earth, including back in England itself. So let's take a look at some of these groups who populate the 13 colonies and the influence that they have. And again, I'll have to do this in a rather cursory manner for time's sake. But let's start with mainline Protestantism and its influence, and in particular, the Church of England, those from the Church of England, the Anglican Christians who came to America. As you know, the Church of England was the official state church. It had been declared the official state church back during the reign of Henry VIII, way back in the 1530s. And basically that had held true through the time of colonization as well. And the Anglican Church was a very powerful and influential force in English society. It was also a very coercive force in English society. Most people of wealth and status, of course, were members of the Anglican Church. And the Anglicans typically operated on the basis of what we call Christian sacralism, which is a concept that dates all the way back to the Emperor Constantine in the early 300s. Now, what in the world is sacralism? Well, when you think about the relationship between the state, the people, and the religious system, there's three options. One would be a situation in which the state has an official religion and virtually everybody in society is coerced or forced to be at least a tacit member of that state church. And that's the situation that had been prevalent, of course, all throughout the Middle Ages with Roman Catholicism. And it also is a concept that was extended into the Protestant Reformation as well. So in England, it's the Anglican Church. The Church of England is the official state church. And all true Englishmen, all Englishmen who were loyal to the nation were expected to be, you know, devout, loyal members of the Church of England as well. And so that's one position. It's basically the union of church and state. Now, the opposite extreme would be what we call secularism, and that is government, basically secular government, non-religious government, and government that in many respects is hostile to Christianity and to religion in general. So those are the two extremes, sacralism and secularism. Now, the founding fathers, in their wisdom, understood there is a third alternative, thank God. And that third alternative is what early on, with Thomas Jefferson and others, was defined as separation of church and state, but not separation of church and state in the sense that that term has been corrupted and misused over the last century or more. But separation of church and state is that the government recognizes the great contributions that Christianity and the church can contribute to society. The goal is not to totally secularize society, but on the other hand, separation of church and state allows for religious tolerance, and even beyond religious tolerance, it allows for religious freedom, religious liberty. So that's the position, of course, that the founding fathers staked out. So we have sacralism on one extreme, the union of church and state. You have secularism, which is hostility toward religion. And then you have the separationist or separatist or separation of church and state position, which holds that these are two separate spheres of influence, the state and religion, but they work cooperatively to oversee the just governing and the prudent social policies in a society. So the Church of England is a sacralistic system. Like the Roman Catholics and like a lot of mainline other Protestants, Anglicans hold to this view, and in that sense, they sought to control the religious beliefs and the allegiance of the English people, and they expected the government to enforce the church's stance on doctrines, on certain moral principles, on social customs, and so on. So in this sense, religious tolerance or religious freedom, even, were regarded as a vice, not a virtue. And why would these professing Christians consider religious freedom to be a vice, not a virtue? Well, because they concluded that religious freedom leads to disunity within a nation. It leads to factionalism. It leads to social and moral breakdown, in their view, and eventually it leads to anarchy. So religious freedom is not the preferred ideal, to say the least. Instead, a controlled state, which controls not only the economy, the social lives, the culture in a nation, but also the religious preferences of people as well. That is what the Church of England seeks for. Now, in terms of Anglican influence in colonial America, most of the colonies, from New York and New Jersey to Delaware, Maryland, down through Virginia, the Carolinas, and Georgia, most of them had as their official state religion in these colonies Anglicanism. Okay. All right, now, there's a second alternative, second of many. And this is the faith of the Puritans. And the Puritans, as you know, I'm sure John has talked a lot about this, taught on on Puritanism probably many times over the years. But Puritans were basically Calvinistic Anglicans. And among mainstream Anglicans, these Calvinists were regarded as radicals or, in their words, enthusiasts, as if the worst thing you could possibly be as a Christian is to be enthusiastic about your religion. And they were also dismissed as nonconformists. You know, these are people that were independent-minded and wouldn't just, agree necessarily with everything that the state church put forward. Now, Puritans, as you know, they get their name from their efforts to reform or to purify the Anglican Church. Many of these Puritans believed that the Anglican Church was very, very corrupt, not utterly corrupt. Obviously, there were good people in the Anglican Church and some good ministers. But in general, the Anglican Church, since it was basically just a department of the government, a department of the state, the Anglican Church was prone to a lot of corruption. And among the Puritans, they believed that this corruption was not only just in terms of its political connections, but also doctrinally and in some respects morally, the Church of England was corrupt. Furthermore, these Puritans believed that a lot of the Anglican clergy were too ignorant of the Bible and Christian history in general, and they were very hypocritical as well. So influenced by John Calvin and the Geneva reformers, Puritans wanted the church to be less ritualistic, less formalistic, and in their minds, they wanted the Anglican Church to be purified and less Catholic. Now, again, for time's sake, I'm going to skip over several points here so we can move on. But in essence, Puritanism, think of it as essentially a holiness movement within Anglicanism itself. J.I. Packer has written, quote, "Puritanism was at heart a movement to raise standards in Christian life in England, with the conversion of England as the final goal." So although Puritans were loyal Anglicans, for the most part, who wanted to reform the church, the Anglican hierarchy was generally very much opposed to the Puritan agenda. Most establishment Anglicans were not interested in their church being purified, or at least by the standards of purification that the Puritans were putting forth. So under the reign of Queen Elizabeth I, again, the second half of the 1500s, then for the first half of the 1600s under the Stuart monarchs, James I and Charles I, these Puritans were regularly harassed, threatened, intimidated, and so many of them chose to leave England and come to America where they thought there would be a freer society in which to operate. Now, by the way, most of these Puritans believed in a Presbyterian form of church government or a Presbyterian church polity. A minority of these Puritans were what we would call Congregationalists. They believed that each local church should be independent and governed democratically. Now, back in England, most of the Puritans were Presbyterians. When they come here to America and settle in Boston and New England, most of the Puritans become Congregationalists. And again, in terms of where they basically focus and settle in, it's primarily New England, Massachusetts, Connecticut, and so on. And I guess one other point I should mention about the Puritans is, like the Church of England, like the Roman Catholics, the Puritans were as sacralistic as these other groups. In other words, they believed that church and state should co-rule over society, and that was their intention when they came to America. One Christian historian, Earl Rademacher, puts it this way. Their aim, the Puritans' aim, was not a democracy, but a theocracy and a holy commonwealth. So they come to America seeking religious freedom and religious free expression, but on the other hand, they're not welcoming and accepting of other kinds of Christians who come to their community. In fact, John Cotton put it best on one occasion. He said that people like Quakers and Baptists and others have total freedom to not associate with us. Okay, so that's That's sort of the Puritan concept of religious liberty. You're free not to associate with us. All right, now, thirdly, and very briefly, because I'm sure you're very familiar with this tradition, is Presbyterianism, of course. These are Reformed Christians influenced by basically two traditions. One would be English Puritan Presbyterianism. In America, most Puritans, as I said, actually favored Congregationalism, but a minority were Presbyterians. And so that's one influence. A second influence would be Scots-Irish Presbyterianism, which was the dominant state religion in Scotland at this time. And these would be people, mostly immigrants from Northern Ireland, who were overwhelmingly Presbyterian in their sentiments. Now, Presbyterian theology, just very simplistically, you know, is oftentimes defined by the TULIP acronym, which I'm sure you're familiar with. And in terms of how Puritan churches were organized and so on, basically Presbyterian churches formed regional associations of semi-independent churches. And between 1705 and 1775, in other words, in the 70 years leading up to the American Revolution, about 400,000 Scots-Irish Presbyterians settled in America. And originally, many of them migrated to Massachusetts, but due to discrimination on the part of the Congregationalists in Massachusetts, most moved on down southward into Connecticut. Eventually, they spread throughout New York, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, and so on. And by the 1740s, just a few years before the American Revolution, Presbyterians are also making inroads into Maryland, Virginia, the Carolinas, and Georgia as well. Now, fourthly would be the Lutherans. And again, just very, very briefly, this is, as you know, this was the original founding mainline Protestant movement led by Martin Luther, beginning in the 1520s and continuing till his death in the late 1540s. But Lutherans are also a presence in America. These would mostly be people coming from Germany and Central Europe, and most of them will settle in the middle colonies, primarily in Pennsylvania. And we'll talk about why so many of these groups received a welcoming in the state of Pennsylvania in particular. Fifthly are the Methodists. And this would be probably historically the last of the mainline Protestant denominations to be founded. It was primarily, of course, as you know, the work of John Wesley and others like the great evangelist George Whitefield, John Wesley's brother, Charles Wesley, the great hymnist, and so on. And John Wesley was essentially the premier church reformer of the 1700s. And working in conjunction with his brother Charles Wesley and George Whitefield and others, he really had a strong impact on American Christianity, as well as in England itself. And like the Puritans a century earlier, John Wesley sees as his calling in life to help purify the church. And just as the Puritans a century earlier had not been welcomed in England, likewise, this Methodist movement in England is unwelcome. But it really takes root in America, especially after the American Revolution. And what else should I mention about it? Well, basically, John Wesley and George Whitefield, their major emphases was on the spiritual new birth. You must be born again. And believe it or not, this was not commonly preached in Christian churches in America at the time. And it was even considered at the time to be a rather radical, you know, view of Christianity. But they emphasized that very, very strongly. And that is a major contributing factor to their success, especially here in America, to the point where, as I said, Methodism was the last of the mainline Christian denomination, Protestant denominations to be founded. But by 1850, a little before the American Civil War, more than one-third of all American church members were Methodists. So it was a movement that expanded and grew extremely rapidly. Now, the Roman Catholics, prior to the 1530s, the Roman Catholic Church was the official state church in England, and it owned a lot of the wealth and a lot of the real estate in England as well at that time. Now, King Henry VIII, as you know, wanted to break with the Roman Catholic Church, not for theological and ecclesiological reasons so much as for personal reasons. And so his motives were anything but pure. But nonetheless, he's the one who established the break between England and Roman Catholicism. And after that time, Roman Catholics then were just a small minority in England. Sometimes they were subject to discrimination. Now, the Roman Catholic Church traditionally, and you probably are aware of this, has always claimed to be the, quote, mother church, the one true church of Christianity. And all, quote, Christians other than Catholics are regarded as schismatics and heretics at best. The Catholic Church was also a very strongly sacralistic tradition, as you know, and ever since the time of the Emperor Constantine in the 300s, Catholic Christianity had promoted this union of church and state. And the Roman Catholic Church, in their minds, should be the officially established church, and it should help co-govern society along with the state. And here in America, Roman Catholics establish a home base in the colony of Maryland. This happens in the early 1630s. The leader here is a man named Cecil Calvert. You might know him as the second Lord Baltimore or the second Baron Baltimore. So he founds the colony of Maryland as a haven for Catholics who are discriminated against back in England. But Maryland grows very, very slowly. It's never able to attract very many Catholic colonists. And so in 1649, something very important happens in Maryland. The state legislature, the colonial legislature, passes what's called the Act of Toleration, which grants tolerance to anyone, quote, professing to believe in the deity of Jesus Christ. This is actually one of the first colonies in American colonial history to grant religious tolerance to anyone who professed faith in Jesus Christ. Now, who's excluded from that would be Jews, and also excluded would be atheists or agnostics, people like that. But anybody else is welcome to come and settle in Maryland. So ironically, this is a colony founded by Catholics who have this strong sacralistic tradition, and yet it's the first colony to officially break with Christian sacralism and open up to any professing Christians. All right, now with that, let's transition to what's called the free church or nonconformist tradition. And let me just say at this point that there used to be a clock in this room, so I'm going to need a little bit of help in terms of what time is 10 till 10, okay, and we need to finish about 10:15, okay, all right, thank you, all right. All right, so lastly, and my main focus this morning will be on what's called the free church or nonconformist tradition. Now, throughout Christian history, various nonconformist individuals and groups had oftentimes arose to offer alternatives to the religious status quo. Now, these were typically people who were dissidents. They were dissatisfied with mainstream institutionalized Christianity of their day, whether it was the Catholic Church or later, in the period we're talking about, the various Protestant state churches as well. Now, many of these nonconformists were very principled visionaries and countercultural rebels. They were reacting against the corruption and the religious hypocrisy in conventional society, while others were merely malcontents and schismatics and heretics, basically. But due to their minority status in society, most of these nonconformists advocated religious tolerance, if not full religious liberty. So these are marginalized people. They want to be free to practice their faith uninhibited. And that requires, of course, a commitment to religious tolerance, if not outright religious liberty on their parts. Now, again, I'm going to very quickly skim over a few groups that are associated with this free church tradition, and one would be the Baptists. And, of course, that eventually will become the most prominent and influential of these nonconformist groups, the Baptists in America. Secondly would be the Quakers, or the Society of Friends, founded by George Fox in 1647. And Quakerism, how it basically departed from most of mainstream Christianity prior to it, was their emphasis not only on the Bible, or sola scriptura, as John Calvin had defined it, but also their emphasis on what they called the indwelling presence of the Holy Spirit, or the inner light. And as time goes on, Quakers begin focusing more on the inner light principle than necessarily on Scripture. And so in that respect, it's very prone to eventual corruption over time. But the Quakers were certainly very prominent and influential Christian dissidents early on. They set up non-liturgical, informal church meetings that emphasized quietude and meditation and so on. They didn't believe in pre-planned worship services or pre-planned teaching or preaching, but everything should be, quote, Spirit-led. Now, for many, many years, my wife and I were involved in the house church movement, and at the outset of that, we were involved in one group that held to some of these same principles. And I can tell you, when you believe that everything should be, quote, Spirit-led to the extent that nobody does any preparation in advance, the teaching and the preaching can be very, very shallow, and you wouldn't believe the music that comes out of a group either. But in America, Quakers actually, even though a very small sect, they become quite influential. And originally, they are banned from all of the colonies except Rhode Island. Rhode Island had been founded by the Baptist Roger Williams, who did believe in religious freedom and separation of church and state. So only in Rhode Island were Quakers allowed, but gradually they begin to infiltrate other areas as well. And, of course, a very prominent Quaker comes along a few years later, William Penn, and he founds the colony of Pennsylvania. And Pennsylvania opens its doors to all people who believe in a deity. That would include Jews and the various varieties of Christians as well. Anabaptists would include groups like Mennonites and Amish, and for time's sake, again, I'll just move on. Other groups that are present in America at this time would include, for instance, Dutch Reformed, primarily in New York, and groups like the Moravians, and there's several others that could be mentioned. But I want to get to the separatists because that leads directly into the founding of Plymouth Colony and the celebration of Thanksgiving, which we'll focus on exclusively next week. Now, these separatists are radical nonconformists. They believe the Church of England is hopelessly corrupt and totally unreformable. So unlike the Puritans, who would like to stay within the Church of England and help transform it into a more prudent, you know, Christian, reliable denomination and faith, the separatists believe that the Church of England is, again, unreformable, unpurifiable, and so they want to separate totally from it. Now, there are also restorationists who envision returning to the simplicity of the early church, and as such, they see themselves as, quote, saints, sacred and set apart from a wicked and persecuting world, and a wicked and persecuting church as well. They reject not only the divine right of kings, but also the divine right of bishops. Okay. Now, the separatists, like most mainstream Christians, believe that salvation comes by grace through Jesus Christ alone, but they also add that this has to be evidenced by personal conversion, a life of faithfulness, and good works. Their source of authority, at least in theory, is the Bible as interpreted by the individual, but in reality, the separatists were like almost all other Christian groups, and that is that separatist ministers exercise a considerable amount of influence and authority over what their congregants believe. Now, they are opposed, of course, to established state-sponsored churches. They believe that Christians should form their own autonomous churches independent of the official state church, and they will restrict church membership to regenerate members who have been redeemed by Christ unto holiness and made a formal profession of faith in Jesus Christ. So separatists are also congregationalists. They believe that every church should be self-governing and democratic. Each local church should be independent, it should be autonomous, and it should call its own minister. Now, the acknowledged founder of this movement is a man named Robert Brown. And Robert Brown was born in 1555, and he dies in 1633. And so early on, he's sort of the leading figure in this movement. In fact, early on, separatists were oftentimes referred to as Brownists. Okay, not Brownies, but Brownists. And following his graduation from Cambridge University, he's ordained as an Anglican minister. Now, Cambridge, back in those days, was a center for Puritanism. Many of you are very familiar with that connection. But Robert Brown became disenchanted with the Puritan efforts to reform the Anglican Church from within. And so in 1581, he helps form the first separatist congregation in England, but he's soon arrested by local authorities. And in fact, over the succeeding years, he's arrested and thrown into jail on numerous occasions. And so at that point, Brown and a few others who were like him, they leave England and they move to the Netherlands, which was the freest nation in Europe, religiously speaking, the freest nation in Europe at the time. And in the Netherlands, they organize their conception of a New Testament church that's based on the doctrine of the priesthood of all believers. Now, in an influential tract which he writes in 1582, you see it there on the outline, a tract called Reformation Without Tarrying for Any, Brown was the first English church leader to call for the separation of church and state. And he followed with another tract called A Book Which Showeth the Life and Manners of All True Christians, in which he argues for church independence and for congregationalism. Now, under Queen Elizabeth, the government, which hardly tolerated even moderate Puritans, certainly has no patience for these radical separatists. And so these separatists and others like them were, religious dissenters in general, were regularly harassed. They were imprisoned, deprived of property, driven into exile, and sometimes just outright executed. And in 1592, and again, Queen Elizabeth is still on the throne at this point, at her behest, Parliament passes what's called the Religion Act of 1592. And the law specifies that anyone who does not attend services in the local Anglican church for at least 40 days, or who otherwise attended private services contrary to the laws and statutes of the nation, were to be thrown into jail and remain without bail until they shall conform themselves and shall yield themselves to come to some church, chapel, or usual place of common prayer, and hear divine service according to Her Majesty's laws, and to make such open submission and declaration of their said conformity. So separatists and other radical Christians are to be jailed without bail, and they're to remain there as long as it takes until the person agrees that they will conform to the statutes of the government and the Church of England. Violators could be exiled from England forever and also served with a very, very stiff fine. Now, that's the situation under Queen Elizabeth. In 1603, she dies, and King James from Scotland becomes the King of England. And with his ascension to the throne, the persecution of nonconformists becomes all the more intensified. And as a result, several hundred separatists flee England, and they seek sanctuary again in Holland, in the Netherlands, during the first century of the 1600s. Again, the Netherlands being the most free country in Europe, religiously speaking, at the time. And in the early 1600s, another separatist church, this one founded in Scrooby, England, under the leadership of John Robinson, emerges. And this was the original congregation of, quote, pilgrims that eventually will immigrate to Holland in 1607. And then 13 years later, they will found the Plymouth Colony in America in 1620. Now, like most other Christians, these separatists tend to be very sacralistic, however, within their own community. So they're opposed to Anglican sacralism, which demands that all Englishmen conform to the Anglican Church and its teachings. But yet in their community, the separatists are just as sacralistic as are the Anglicans or the Roman Catholics or any other group at the time. In England, these people were a very tiny minority. They were on the fringes of society, and they didn't try to attempt to transform mainstream society or the established state church because they thought it was totally unreformable. And they were generally uninvolved in the larger social and political issues of their day as well. But in their own community, and this is true when they found Plymouth Colony in Massachusetts, again, these people are as sacralistic as the Anglicans or the Puritans or the Roman Catholics, for that matter. And one Christian historian, Williston Walker, puts it this way. Neither pilgrims nor Puritans had any thought of establishing liberty for men to do as they pleased, nor would any be inclined to any general toleration such as we now value, have furnished motives definite enough to have led our ancestors to the New World. So in other words, these people are not seeking a free and open society in which they can actively participate. They come to America to set up a unique Christian community according to their principles and beliefs. And anyone who would like to join them is certainly welcome. But for outsiders who don't conform to their system, like the Puritans and others, they feel that those people should be excluded from their community because in the mindset of these people at the time, religious diversity, all it does is cause problems. And so if we want a unified, cohesive, well-functioning society and culture, then everybody pretty much needs to believe the same thing. In other words, everybody pretty much needs to believe the right things, which means everybody pretty much needs to believe what I think. Okay. So these are the people that will found Plymouth Colony in Massachusetts, and we'll again focus on this, more detail next week. Now, I don't intend to skew your view of these pilgrims or the Puritans or any others in a particularly negative sense, but, you know, we need to speak the truth about these matters. And very, very few Christians at this time in history valued in any way religious tolerance, let alone religious freedom. Okay. So that's going to be a further development, and it's going to be spearheaded by some influential individuals and groups in America as we move toward the American Revolution. So, I'm kind of time blind here, and we have 6 or 7 minutes. So, comments, questions? Yes, please.
Did the Episcopalians came from
England? Oh, yes. And again, I was trying to just eliminate as many details as possible. But what became eventually the American Episcopal Church grew out of the Anglican community. After the American Revolution, anything associated with England had a negative, implication. And so Anglicans in America after the Revolution will change to the Episcopal Church in America. That was their official name at the time. Yeah. Yes, please. Sally? Yeah. Okay. Baptists, of course, become very, very influential in American history. We also attract some, quote, Anabaptists. The term Anabaptist means rebaptizers, and it goes back to the 1520s and at the outset of the Protestant Reformation. And remember, at that time, all of Europe was, quote, Christian, or at least Catholic, which means all Europeans were baptized in the local church at birth. Okay. Now, the Anabaptists believed that, based on their understanding of Scripture, baptism was for people who intentionally choose to follow Christ, and that would require they'd be older children or, you know, young adults or whatever. So that's where the term Anabaptist comes from. The Anabaptists influenced what later became the Baptist movement, the English Baptists. The primary difference between the two is that Anabaptists intentionally wanted to self-segregate from mainstream society, which they considered to be pseudo-Christian. The Anabaptists were also almost exclusively pacifistic. They believed that any engagement in war was un-Christian. And furthermore, they refused to swear allegiance to any state government. And so those are some of the major differences between Anabaptists, Mennonites, Amish, people like that, later Hutterites, and Baptists, as we know Baptists. Does that help?
Yes.
Yes, yes, please.
The Quakers the only foundation that believed in abolishing slavery?
No, they were Quakers the only...
What was the question, please?
Were Quakers the only Christians who believed in abolishing slavery, before the American Revolution? And no, they were not, but they were very influential in that movement. And again, Quakers would just make up a tiny percent of the American Christian population. I don't know, 2% maybe, something like that. But because they stood for certain moral principles that were unpopular at the time, they had an influence far in excess of their numbers. So it is true that the Quakers were really in the forefront of the abolition movement from the very beginning, well before the American Revolution even. And a lot of their leaders were very forthright in their opposition to slavery as well.
Question over here.
Yes.
Deism apparently must have come in prior to the Founding Fathers and Constitution. Where did that come from?
Deism, which later will morph into what we call Unitarianism. Deism is the belief in a universal, eternal creator God who created the universe, and of which we are a product, and we're made in God's image. But deists do not believe that God in any way interacts in human affairs, which means that God does not interact in our personal lives either, which makes prayer rather inconsequential when you think about it. So God has set up this world, this universe, to operate on the basis of natural physical laws. Furthermore, being made in the image of God, we've been endowed with a rational mind, if we'll use it. We've also been endowed with moral sensibilities. So according to the deists, later Unitarians, this idea that God has actively been involved in human affairs, such as is recorded in the Bible, that just makes no sense, frankly, because God created a good universe with good human beings in it, and God does not need to be involved. So you might look at the deist concept of God. God is basically tantamount to an absentee landlord. Okay, he owns this world, he owns the universe, but he's not involved in it in any decipherable way. So he's left the world to run on its own accord, and that means we have a mind, we have moral sensibilities. Frankly, we don't need God you know, to live our lives in a way that will please and honor him. Okay. By the way, prior to deism and Unitarianism being a significant influences in America, certain elements of mainstream Christianity in America were becoming theologically very liberal. And Harvard, later Yale, would be classic examples of the corruption of biblical Christianity becoming liberal, or what they like to call today progressive Christianity, which oftentimes led to deism and Unitarianism. By 1805, Harvard is officially Unitarian. By the way, you might know there was an article in the paper just a few weeks ago. Harvard just appointed a new university chaplain who's an atheist.
Dog, that works. Yes.
Morning. Thank you for letting me make my comment. Your view of American history and mine are sharply different. With respect, I do believe that you know, God did have a special move in out of England, the move that Jesus did through his people. And when he sent the people over, especially to Massachusetts in that time period,
right,
it was a move of God that he orchestrated. And so what I learned is to be able to look at American history from what God was doing from a Christian worldview. So I just, your view just is so, leaves me so,
yeah,
distraught. But okay. My view is that Jesus really did good things that were miracles, and that it's special. And
yeah.
I read Marshall Foster's book called The American Covenant. Have you read that book?
I have not read that, but I've read a lot on the so-called Christian America thesis. Yes,
yeah, I know the so-called Christian America. That's my people. I mean, I embrace that. I was taught that.
Right.
So-called, you know, people. But honestly, it's real, and
well,
it is true. And so your view makes me feel like I can't even be proud of what Jesus did in our people. And so that's where
in no way does my position discount God's involvement in the founding of America and in certain influential people's lives in American history. God has been involved. Now, the Christian America thesis that you're referring to is very problematic from a factual point of view. But there's no question that – let me put it this way. Maybe you can relate to this. I fully believe that America has been the most has been the one nation in all of human history most uniquely influenced by the Christian faith. I believe that wholeheartedly. We have been very influenced by the Christian faith. That's totally different, however, from buying into the Christian America thesis as it's oftentimes propagated. Yeah. We could talk further if you'd like about that. Sure, be happy to. Do we have one more?
Probably needs to be the last one.
Yes, okay.
Theologically, what was the main difference between the Puritans and the Pilgrims?
Okay, theologically, well, frankly, not that much. They are both what we would call Calvinistic, Reformed Christians in their general theology. They both are adherents to Sola Scriptura. And the Pilgrims, the Separatists, would have been in alignment with the Puritans on most theological and even some ecclesiological matters. In other words, they were congregationalists, like most American Puritans were. So the difference would be that the Separatists believed that mainstream English society and European society was only pseudo-Christian, and likewise, the main Christian denominations were sadly lacking in integrity. So a true Christian would want nothing to do with these denominations that were misrepresenting, in their minds, true Christianity. So true Christians want nothing to do with the world, the world system, including the major religious systems in the world. Whereas the Puritans held out that hopefully they could help reform the Church of England. They eventually gave up on that mission here in America, however, and they formed their own denomination, Congregationalism or Presbyterianism, of course. So that would be the main difference. Okay. All right. Well, that was a lot of material to cover, and my apologies for going through a lot of it very, very superficially, but I knew it was going to be quite a sprint. We'll slow down next week, and we'll take a look at the separatists, God's involvement in this whole process, and the founding of Plymouth Colony and the first Thanksgiving. So very much looking forward to going through that with you. Thanks. Thank you. Yes, close in prayer. Lord, we fully recognize just how extraordinarily blessed and privileged we are. In your grace and goodness and in your providential care, you have allowed us to live in a time in which we can freely express our faith, our practices, our practices related to our faith in you. And we have so much to be thankful for. But we also understand that for those who are so utterly blessed, we have great responsibilities as well to be a source of light and love and truth in the midst of a society and culture that's becoming increasingly dysfunctional and degenerate and chaotic. Help us to take our responsibilities very, very seriously, and to understand that you've put us right here, right now, at this time in history, in this nation, for a particular reason. So may we follow through on that regardless of what it costs us, regardless of the issues that we have to take a principled stand on. And Lord, just use us to further your kingdom. And I pray this in Jesus' name. Amen.